this occasion, we'd like to invite you to turn off your iPhone 5, Galaxy S3, or what have you.
I have a gravity.
Yeah, good. Put it in silent mode or whatever it might be. Thank you all very much for coming. And should I ask you to move up? Maybe more people might come back. That happens sometimes.
Please move up, folks.
Let's fill in this.
As comfortable.
We have all this expensive New York real estate, so we might as well use it. There you go. Okay, that's good enough. If we need to adjust again, we'll adjust again. Om Agyana Timiran Tasya Gyananjana Savakaya Chakshurn Miditam Jina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopistam Stapitam Jina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tathati Shapatantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Jata Padakamanam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatan Vitam Stam Sajivam Shatvaitam Shavadhutam Pravijana Sehitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakan Vitamstra He Krishna Kurana Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kamshana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hori Priye Vansha Kopitarubhyascha Kripa Sindho Vyayevacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivas Adi Gaur Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
I guess that was an invitation to put this here. Is that good? No, then we need it high up.
Yeah, little type. That looks about right. Good. So we're reading from the, let's see, is this the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, Maharaj.
611, huh?
Yes, Maharaj.
And that's, let's see if I'm in the right place. Balam Balabhatam Chaham Kamaradhi.
I think so.
Yeah?
No, I think
no,
that's,
I don't think that's
no,
right.
No,
that's
the
seven.
Next
that's
seven,
nine.
Seven.
Okay. I was wondering how that got there. Totally wrong. Okay. Why does this do this to me?
So Maharaj, it's Shusho Deshe Pratistapya.
Okay, that's what it should be. This funny thing plays funny. Okay.
A small print.
A small
should
print.
I get a bigger, should I get a bigger one?
read a hard Gita there?
I can get to this. It's just for some reason. I'll just start from the beginning of the sixth chapter and page over.
Oh, yes, we do.
I can do it this way.
Awesome.
I can still do it, I'm sure.
Marge, your hard Gita is coming here.
Hard Gita.
Yes.
You all get the easy Gita, I get the hard one. Thumb around until you get to 11. Okay, this is much better. So we're in 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, text 11. And here, Lord Krishna is describing what's called Ashtanga Yoga system, or the Eightfold Practice of Yoga. Perhaps it's the form of yoga that might be, in outline, most familiar, where we sit in a certain posture, and then we practice breathing exercises, and then meditation, and so on. This system comes from the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita gives many different forms of yoga. Dhyana yoga, Jnana yoga, Karma yoga, Bhakti yoga. They're all, many different kinds of yoga are described in Bhagavad Gita. And now we're going to hear about this system of Jnana yoga or Ashtanga yoga. Shucho deshe pratishtapya sthiram asanam atmanaha natyuchritam natinicham chayalajana kushottaram tatraikagram manakritva yata chitendriya kriyaha upavishyasane yunjad yogam atma vishuddhaya. To practice yoga, one should go to a secluded place and should lay kusha grass on the ground and then cover it with a deer skin and a soft cloth. The seat should be neither too high nor too low and should be situated in a sacred place. The yogi should then sit on it very firmly and practice yoga to purify the heart by controlling his mind, senses, and activities, and fixing the mind on one point. Purport. Sacred place refers to places of pilgrimage. In India, the yogis, the transcendentalists, or the devotees, all leave home and reside in sacred places such as Prayag, Mathura, Vrindavan, Rishikesh, and Haridwar, and in solitude practice yoga where the sacred rivers like the Jamuna and the Ganges flow. But often this is not possible, especially for Westerners. The so-called yoga societies in big cities may be successful in earning material benefit, but they are not at all suitable for the actual practice of yoga. One who is not self-controlled and whose mind is not undisturbed cannot practice meditation. Therefore, in the Brihannaradiya Purana, it is said that in Kali Yuga, the present age, when people in general are short-lived, slow in spiritual realization, and always disturbed by various anxieties, the best means of spiritual realization is chanting the holy name of the Lord. Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nama Iva Kaivalam, Hare Nama Iva Kaivalam, Kalo Nasjeva, 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 Gatira Nita. In this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the only means of deliverance
is chanting the holy name of the Lord. There's no other way, no other way, no other way. So let's look at this, these verses. Shucho deshe pratishtanti. Shucho means a purified place. In Sanskrit and Hindi, they're called tirthasthans, or places of pilgrimage. And Srila Prabhupada mentions some of those places, like Vrindavan, Haridwar, Rishikesh, Prayag, Varanasi. There are many such places in India. And one is advised to begin one's yoga practice there. The idea is that this yoga system involves a withdrawal from material activities. It's not something that I just do for 20 minutes on the way to work. It's something much more serious than that, something much more demanding than that, and something with that's very powerful. This yoga system that's described here enables one to get free from material existence, which is the real goal of yoga. It enables one to get free from all material entanglements and rise to the transcendental platform. So that's a very ambitious program. Very ambitious program. And for that, the yogis would leave home. They might go to the forest to practice yoga. There are many examples. Or they would go to a place by the bank of the Ganges or the bank of the Jamuna, which were very sanctified places. Even Bombay would not be the place to go. It would have to be a sacred place, a quiet place, secluded place, where you can imagine that it's very calm and peaceful. And maybe the only sounds you might hear are the sounds of the river, the sounds of the birds, just this sound of the wind in the forest. Very quiet, very peaceful, very still. And in that atmosphere, the yogi would begin his practice. Even more so, these places, Shucho Deshe, would be places of spiritual culture since thousands of years, and the yogi would get the benefit of the spiritual atmosphere, special spiritual atmosphere of that place. So that's called Shucho Deshe. Shucho Deshe Pratishtapya Sthiram Asanam Atmana. Asana, we've heard that term. Asana literally means a seat, and Sthiram Asana means a firm seat, a steady place. One sits down. The actual yoga system is not sort of wandering around. The yogi would make this seat, and he would stay there. He's going to be there for, well, in previous ages, 50,000 years, 80,000 years. In the Vedic literature, we learn that there are different ages of historical time that travel in a circle, the cycle. And the first age is called Satyayuga. And in that age, people's lifetime, their lifespan was 100,000 years. 100,000 years. We hear sometimes in biblical literature, well, these long lifetimes for Methuselah or someone. And according to the Vedic knowledge, people used to live so long. Then the next age comes, Treta Yuga, and it's diminished. People live for 10,000 years. And by the end of that age, the next age comes, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and then the lifetime is 1,000 years. And gradually it comes to the present age, Kali Yuga, where 100 years is considered impressive. If someone's 100 years old in America, you get a letter from the President of the United States.
So, in the Sutra Yuga, people would practice this system, and they would sit, and they would meditate for tens of thousands of years. So, sthiramasana, they would have to have a very suitable seat. Not too chutam, not too nicha. Not too high, not too low. And chailajana kushottaram. They would put down a certain kind of sacred grass. It's not like grass like your lawn. They're sort of long grass called kusha grass. And that's a very special item. And deer skin and a soft cloth. It's said that the tigers won't go where there's a... if you're sitting on a deer skin, the tigers will stay away. Yeah, that's useful knowledge in New York City. But actually they used to go to the forest, and in the forest the tigers would be there, and that can disturb your mind. So they would put down the deer skin and not worry about the tigers, and they would have a soft cloth, and this is your traditional asana. Then, tatraikagram mana kritva. Now, what is the purpose of all this? Tatra, there, ekagram mana kritva, to make the mind one-pointed. What is our mind like? It's all over the place. It's like dancing here and there. It's going here, it's going there, and we're thinking of so many things. The mind is restless and unsteady, and it's moving here and it's moving there. It's thinking of this and it's thinking of that, and it's fantasizing about this and imagining that and remembering this and wishing for that and wondering about this. And it's a very creative little fellow, this mind, and it's jumping everywhere from topic to topic to topic to topic. And the business of the yogi is to take that mind and to fix it on one subject. Fix it on one, in one direction only. Ekagra mana kritva. To make it one-pointed. Which makes the mind very powerful. The mind is already powerful, but it's powerfully moving us around and around and around. But if that mental energy, if that attention is concentrated on one point, then that attention becomes very, very strong. That one point we'll learn about later in the coming verses. They wouldn't simply meditate on a flame or a doorknob or a pattern, but they would meditate on the presence of God within the heart. That was their meditation. So, tatraikagram mana kritva. Preliminarily, they might meditate just on something, just to fix the mind, get the mind to that ideal of being focused on one point. The goal is to bring the mind to focus on the presence of God in the heart. Dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa vajantiyam yogina. So yata chitendriya kriyaha. Chitendriya. Chitta indriya. To control the... indriya means the senses. In the... according to the yogic texts, there are two kinds of senses called Gyanendriyas and Karmendriyas. Gyana means knowledge. So the Gyanendriyas are the knowledge-gathering senses.
basically, we'd say like data gathering, information gathering. There's the ear, data is coming, sound in the form of sound. There's the eye, we're seeing something. We're gathering visual information. Eyes, ears, the nose, olfactory input. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, we're getting sensations of taste, we're finding out what something tastes like, and touch. Is it hard? Is it soft? Is it, what's it like? We're getting information from our sense of touch. And these senses also are like roaming about, getting information here, getting from my eyes, or wandering here and there. My ears are attracted here and attracted there. My tongue is especially attracted, therefore so many restaurants and snack shops and little kiosks and food carts. So my tongue is attracted. All the senses are pulling me. In one place in Vedic literature it said that we're like a man with five wives. And one wife is pulling and saying, come on, let's do this. Another wife is pulling, come on, let's do that. Another wife's calling, come on, why don't we do this? Another wife's calling, oh, come on. So we're pulled in every direction by the senses, all of them drawing our attention in different ways. So those are the Gyanendriyas. And the Karmendriyas are not what we usually think of as senses, but in the literature they're called senses. Active senses. A Karmendriya means doing things. So the arms are senses, two arms, two legs, arms, legs. The tongue counts in both categories because the tongue not only gets information, but it puts out information, it speaks. Two hands, two legs, tongue, then the what? Genitals are there, that's also an active sense. And fifth one? Rectum. That's also necessary activity. So these are the active senses. So active senses and knowledge gathering senses and Chitendriya Kriya means the senses are now going to be controlled. Now the senses are, they do what they want and they engage me. Come on, let's do this. Come on, let's do that. And I'm pulled by my senses to go here and there, by those knowledge gathering senses. They get knowledge. Whoa, let's do this. And then they engage the active senses. Okay, let's make a move. So the yogi practices controlling his senses. He regulates his senses. He's compared later in the chapter to a tortoise, which is a very clever creature and can extend its limbs or retract its limbs at its own will. It's under his control. It's not just that he retracts them, but he can. And he does, so that when it's appropriate, he extends his senses, and when it's appropriate, he withdraws his senses. So the yogi practices to get control of the senses. They're called, he's called master of the senses. Ekagram, tatraikagram, manakritva, yatachitendriya kriyaha, Upavishyasane yunjad, he should sit in this way. Yoga atma vishuddhaye. Vishuddha. Shuddha means pure. Shuddha means pure. And vishuddha means very, very pure. So the yogi practices to make his mind or his heart very, very pure. Now my mind is full of gunk. All sorts of stuff is in my mind. But the yogi practices making his mind very, very pure so that he's thinking of only of spiritual, that his spiritual goal, of spiritual reality, of the purpose of his life, and his heart is becoming more and more pure. We're looking at it another way. There are a few ways we can look at it. There are three, maybe you've heard, three qualities or modes of material nature. There's goodness, there's passion, and there's ignorance. In ignorance, one is lazy, one is dull, one is sometimes intoxicated, sometimes crazy, mad. We see sometimes people who are roaring drunk, they're in the mode of ignorance. People who are addicted to, your heroin addicts are in the mode of ignorance. Or just people who are really dull. So that's the quality of ignorance. And the quality of passion is all about thirst and intense desire to experience and enjoy, and therefore to achieve, to acquire, to have lots and lots and lots and lots of demands and desires and wants, longings and passions, great quests to build an empire. This is all in the mode of passion. And knowledge is characterized by peacefulness, tranquility, development of knowledge. That's the motive of goodness. Very passions are now quiet. One is awake, but one is not full of demands to have this and to have that. He's tranquil. And in that tranquil state, he develops knowledge. So Atma Vishuddhaye means he's becoming purified, freed from ignorance, free from passion, free from those two lower qualities. And he's coming to the mode of goodness, or even beyond goodness, there's what's called pure goodness, which is transcendental goodness. Or another way of looking at it is that the mind is subject to anger, lust, kam, krodh, greed, kam, krodh, lobh, mada, madness, craziness, crazy mind, moha, bewilderment, and envy. Why does she have it? Why couldn't I have it? What do I have to do to get one of those? If I had, then I could. Envy. So these are all impurities of mind. The yogi is not going to be able to focus his mind on the ultimate objective of life, on the supreme transcendence, while his mind at the same time is thinking, damn it, why does she have that iPhone? And why couldn't I? What would it take for me to have an iPhone like that? How come he's got that beautiful girlfriend? And what would it take to interest her in me? And that's another story altogether. Or if he's thinking, how do I get back at this guy? He did me wrong, and I should, I was right, and he was wrong, and he wouldn't admit it, and he really deserves to be taught a lesson. Anger, lust, greed, bewilderment, envy, all of these things the yogi is getting free from. He's meditating, he's in tranquil place, sacred place, he's controlling his mind, he's controlling his senses, and his heart is becoming very, very pure. This is the beginning of the yoga system, and we're going to read a little bit more about it in the coming verses. But these are, in one sense, the preliminaries of yoga. And as Srila Prabhupada points out, these things are not the standard in Western yoga societies. The yoga society doesn't say, join us and come for 6 months or a year or 5 years to this sacred place because we're all going to meditate there. And so many other rules of the yoga system are set aside. And generally, the goal is also not the same. We're not focused on self-realization, on realization of the Supreme, realization of God, but we want to look better, feel better, have maybe a sort of a lighter, happier feeling. And that's fine, but that's not the classical or standard system of yoga. You can even say that's not actually what's meant by yoga. The meaning has changed to become something else. And that brings us to the end of this verse, and I'm wondering whether I should go forward. So would you like to hear about the rest of the yoga system? Yeah? Okay. We'll read two more verses then. Samam kaya shiro grivam tariyan nachalam stidaha sampreksha nasikagram swam dishas janavalokani prashantat ma digata bhi brahmachari vrte stidaha manasam yamya machchitto yukta asita matparaha. One should hold one's body, neck, and head erect in a straight line and stare steadily at the tip of the nose. Thus, with an unagitated, subdued mind, devoid of fear, completely free from sex life, one should meditate upon me within the heart and make me the ultimate goal of life. Okay, and Srila Prabhupada explains all of these terms, so maybe we'll go through it. He begins actually with the end. The goal, what's the goal of this yoga system? The goal of life is to know Krishna, who is situated within the heart of every living being as Paramatma, the four-handed Vishnu form. I should explain that a little bit. Krishna appears in different forms, and one of them is the form known as Vishnu, which is a form with four arms and dark blue complexion and holding various symbols, you can say. Not these symbols, but symbolic. Sometimes they're called weapons. A conch, a lotus, a club, and a disc, a chakra. And that form of Vishnu is said to be, or is, seated within the heart of the living being. It's said that God is within everyone, and this is the form in which God is envisioned, this form of Vishnu within the heart. So the goal of the yogi is to focus his mind on Krishna in this Vishnu form, residing within his own heart. Dhyana vastata taktitena manasa pashanti yam yogina. And the yogi becomes so purified and so accomplished in yoga that he's able to see that Vishnu, not just think about, but actually see God within his heart. The yoga process is practiced in order to discover and see this localized means within, form of Vishnu, and not for any other purpose. The localized Vishnu Murti, Vishnu form, is the plenary representation of Krishna dwelling within one's heart, a fully empowered representation of Krishna. One who has no program to realize this Vishnu Murti is uselessly engaged in mock yoga practice and is certainly wasting his time. Strong words. Krishna is the ultimate goal of life, and the Vishnu Murti situated in one's heart is the object of yoga practice. To realize this Vishnu Murti within the heart, one has to observe complete abstinence from sex life. Therefore, one has to leave home and live alone in a secluded place, remaining seated, as mentioned above. One cannot enjoy sex life daily at home or elsewhere and attend a so-called yoga class and thus become a yogi. Well, that's called brahmachari vritte sthita. Brahmachari means, and Prabhupada will explain it further, but it means celibate, no sex. Brahmachari vrata, vrata means a vow, no sex. Brahmachari vritte sthita. So in the yoga system, that's another requirement, that in this meditation, one has to give up all sexual connections, all sexual activity, and we'll see that means even within the mind. One has to practice controlling the mind and avoiding all kinds of sense gratification, of which sex life is the chief. In the rules of celibacy written by the great sage Yajnavalkya, it is said, karmana manasa vacha sarva avastasu sarvada sarvatra maituna tyago brahmacharjam prachakshate. The vow of brahmacharja is meant to help one completely abstain from sexual indulgence in work, words, and mind. At all times, under all circumstances, and in all places. Sarvavastasu, sarvada, sarvatra. No one can perform correct yoga practice through sexual indulgence. We've seen in recent times that there are some people who advertise themselves as yogis, and they're promoting that yoga means to kind of let go of all these restrictions that are holding you back and become a free spirit, and that means lots of good sex. And of course this is a very popular approach to yoga that appears from time to time. It's certainly appealing to many people. It does very well in Hollywood and other such places. But that's not what's talked about here. In fact, the opposite. Brahmacharya is taught, therefore, from childhood, when one has no knowledge of sex life. Children at the age of 5 are sent to the Gurukul, or the place of the spiritual master, and the master trains the young boys in the strict discipline of becoming brahmacharis. Without such practice, no one can make advancement in any yoga, whether it be dhyana, jnana, or bhakti. So, this yoga, as we mentioned, was practiced in a previous age, and the entire cultural atmosphere was different. Entire cultural atmosphere was different. The young boys were taught from an early age that to keep their minds off of sex life, now, in the present age, by the time the boy is a little bit grown up, if he's not very much interested in sex life, then his parents start to wonder what's wrong with him. They go to a counselor or they go to a psychologist and they say, you know, is something wrong, or is it, can we expect, do we just have to wait a little longer, or the boy's not chasing after girls, what's wrong? And maybe the psychologist says, that's all right, just you wait, or just wait, and, you know, good medical advice, wait and see, and if necessary, then we'll see what's to be done. And certainly by the time the young people are in college, then it's, they must be having sex. If they're not, then it's like, you're what? You know, that the V word? Come on. There's some very interesting, the novelist Tom Wolfe wrote a book. Okay, I'm Charlotte Simmons, in dealing with a young lady from a sort of a rural background who goes to a prestigious liberal arts college, and there she finds an entirely different way of life, where bathrooms are shared and bedrooms are shared and everything is shared, and where the expectation that to be not sexually experienced is to be weird. And he has a passage in the novel which he got from first-hand research, actually hanging out in college dormitories, where a young lady is speaking to sort of an old friend and begging her to deflower her because she's still a virgin and it's just too much to be she's out of everything in that way. So she's begging him. He says, I'm like your brother. She says, no, but therefore only you. And so on it goes. Goes. I'm not endorsing the novel. I'm just saying this was the research. And how different this was, that's the point, from the Vedic culture. In the Vedic culture, the idea was that there was no sex, unless there was marriage. There was no sex. I'll give you another example. This is from my own personal research. I was at the University of California at the beginning of the semester one year. Not actually at the university, but I was staying just near the campus, and I took my morning walk on the campus. And they had these orientation booklets for the incoming students. And it covered all sorts of stuff. And one of the topics was the gay scene. And two topics. One was the cult scene. Watch out for cults. Very careful about people who are too friendly and have some religious message, because they could really mess up your life. So there's a page dedicated to that. Very important. And then there was a page dedicated to the gay scene, which was sort of a, well, try it on and see if it's for you. If you think this might be for you, then here are the places where you go, and here's sort of step one, step two, step three, step four, here's how you meet people, here's how you, and you know, try it on, and if that's you, then good, and if it's not, then that's fine. So that's also part of, you know, very modern. For me to sit here and say that that is something strange would be to very politically incorrect. This is just part of modern life. So in
in this old Vedic system, no sex life. And in the modern day, well, maybe with a boy, maybe with a girl, not depending on which you are. And in fact, whichever you are, you might want to try the opposite one. If you're a boy, what do you think about being a girl? If you're a girl, what do you think about being a boy? Or if you're a girl, how about trying other girls? If you're a boy, how about other boys? How about mix and match, a little of this, a little of that? Sort of find your identity, and or you can just go the old, normal way and just, have a lot of bedtime. Hare Krishna. So that's not part of what's going on here in this yoga system. The yogi's in the forest, and he's not thinking, well, am I a boy, am I a girl? Am I more interested in the opposite sex, the same sex? That's not what he's meditating there in the forest. His Vishuddha, Atma Vishuddha, his consciousness is becoming very, very pure. And to accomplish that, he puts aside all sex. One who, however, follows the rules and regulations of married life, having a sexual relationship only with his wife, and that also under regulation, is also called a brahmachari. Such a restrained householder brahmachari may be accepted in the bhakti school. But the jnana and dhyana schools do not even admit householder brahmacharis. They require complete abstinence without compromise. In the bhakti school, a householder brahmachari is allowed controlled sex life because the cult of bhakti yoga is so powerful that one automatically loses sexual attraction being engaged in the superior service of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Vishaya vinivartante niraha rasya dehinaha rasa varjam risopyasya param drishtva nivartate. Whereas others are forced to restrain themselves from sense gratification, a devotee of the Lord automatically refrains because of superior taste. Other than the devotee, no one has any information of that superior taste. So in these different schools, the Ashtanga Yoga, Dhyana Yoga, it's just very definite, no sex. You want to enter this school, no sex. That's the rule. All these sitting postures and breathing exercises and so on are useless if one is having sex. So that's the rule. Brahmachari vrtesthitaha. The bhakti yoga system is different because it's not involved in simply restraining the senses and drilling the respiration and a sort of mechanical process. It's engaged, it consists of engaging one's entire being in the service of Krishna. And in that system, even sex can be engaged in the service of Krishna. One can be a householder and a married person, and marriage involves sex, and then children, and the whole, that whole complete side of life can be part of bhakti yoga. So the bhakti yoga system stands in distinction from the other yoga systems for that reason. And the bhakti yoga yogi also sees that there's something higher than sex, which is his aim of life. And therefore, he doesn't have to be a member of Sexaholics Anonymous.
there is such an organization. They're not making it up. It's not that he's preoccupied with sex, because he has a higher purpose. So his, even though he may have sex, it's not unrestrained or profligate. Nigatabhi, one cannot be fearless. Fearlessness is one sitting there fearlessly. One cannot be fearless unless one is fully in Krishna consciousness. A conditioned soul, those of us who are under the conditions of material life, it is fearful due to his perverted memory, his forgetfulness of his eternal relationship with Krishna. Bhagavatam says, Bhayam dhritiya viniveshatasya rishada petasya viparyayo smritihi. Krishna consciousness is the only basis for fearlessness. Therefore, perfect practice is possible for a person who's Krishna conscious. And since the ultimate goal of yoga practice is to see the Lord within, a Krishna conscious person is already the best of all yogis. The principles of the yoga system mentioned herein are different from those of the popular so-called yoga societies. Well, I can say more, but there's enough there that might provoke some questions, so maybe I'll stop here and see what questions you might have. Mm-hmm. Let's knock that one.
For question.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Do I know of any women during the Vedic age who were intellectuals, philosophers, who wrote something?
Yes.
I don't know of any who've written something. I'm trying to think if there's something particularly, but there are women whose philosophical thoughts have been recorded. The Devahuti, the mother of Kapil Dev, was taught the Sankhya philosophy by her son, Kapila, and she attained perfection in that system. Kunti Devi was the aunt of Lord Krishna, and her prayers are recorded in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, this is very interesting. There's, in the Bhakti Yoga system, there were many women who were exceedingly advanced. And just to give an example, Krishna is coming into the city of Hastinapur, I believe it was. Hastinapur or Dwarka? I think it was Hastinapur. And this is the capital city, and quite the place, you know, very cosmopolitan. And the women at that time wouldn't just sort of mix with the crowd. They would go up to the rooftops to see. There's a big procession going on, and all the men are in the street, and the women are going to the rooftops, and they're looking down on the scene and talking about what they're seeing. And in one sense, it's like gossip. You know, we get up on the roof and we see what's going on and we gossip about what's going on. But their gossip is described as being superior to the philosophy of the Vedas. Because they were speaking about Krishna, and when you read what they were speaking, it's highly evolved spiritual understanding. It's highly evolved spiritual understanding. So that they were conversant with truths that yogis sitting and meditating for 10,000 years or 50,000 years hadn't caught up with. They were far more advanced. Because they had understood their relationship with Krishna. And they'd understood who Krishna was. So they were more advanced than all those yogis practicing so strenuously according to all the rules and regulations that we read about today. And finally you come to the greatest yogis. Who are the greatest yogis? The gopis. It's very, very, in one sense, counterintuitive that who are the greatest sages, the greatest philosophers, the greatest practitioners of yoga? Cowherd girls. Not any cowherd girl, but the women of this particular cowherd village, Vrindavan, who were spontaneously attracted to Krishna. They're described as the greatest of all yogis, the greatest of all philosophers, the highest. Krishna, when Krishna had left Vrindavan, Krishna spent his childhood years in Vrindavan, and then he left to go to Hastinapur and Dwarka. That's all described in Krishna's biography. And when he left, all the devotees in Vrindavan were just thinking about him. And Krishna had an associate in Dwarka named Uddhava. And Uddhava was he was Krishna's personal advisor. He was one of these people who can analyze a situation and understand everything and give you the best advice. He was a student of a very great sage, Brihaspati, a very learned person. And Krishna told Uddhava, I want you to bring a message from me to these inhabitants of Vrindavan. So Krishna wrote out a message and brought it to Vrindavan. And he was astonished to see how these people of Vrindavan were always absorbed in thinking of Krishna. They couldn't forget, they couldn't stop thinking of Krishna even for a moment. They were so absorbed in thinking of Krishna, they were always remembering Krishna's activities, Krishna's smile, Krishna's glances, Krishna's playing on his flute, how the forest animals had been attracted to Krishna. They were just thinking on and on and on and on about Krishna. And Uddhava realized that he'd been sent there not just to deliver a message, but for his own education. He's thinking, you know, I'm like a graduate of Yale, you know, I've studied under the great sage Brihaspati, and I know something. But then he saw that these cowherd women were far more advanced than he was in understanding Krishna and loving Krishna. So he thought that if I could take birth again in this cowherd village of Vrindavan as a little clump of grass, that would be very good. Because then these gopis, these women of Vrindavan, might sometimes walk on me. And for me to have them walk on my head would be such a blessing. I would be so purified if they would put their feet on my head. So he was sincerely praying like that, because he saw they were the most exalted. There was no comparison. And still, that standard is there. There's many, many books written about this. There's these devotees are better, and then these, and these, and these, and these, and then when you get to the top, it's the gopis. So they're worshipped, actually, as being the greatest devotees of Krishna. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Forgive me for being a little misunderstood about it, but can you explain exactly who Krishna was?
There's a good question. Forgive me for not understanding, but could you explain exactly who Krishna was? I'll do my best. When we speak of Krishna, we're speaking of a person. As you're a person and I'm a person, Krishna is also a person. And he appeared, lived on earth about 5,000 years ago. And he, in his childhood, he played as a cowherd in that village I was just talking about. And then later, he left the village and he lived as a prince or a king. And you can find out the details of what he did in that time in our books. Famously, he on one occasion acted as a charioteer for his friend Arjuna and spoke this book of knowledge that we're reading from called, yes, Bhagavad Gita.
So he's like the creator?
Yeah, now that's the, on the one side he's a person, he's doing all these things in the world. On the other side, or looking at the matter more deeply, he's seen to be the original person, or the supreme person. We're all persons, but none of us can rightly claim, I'm the supreme person. That's Krishna. He's called, the book is called Bhagavad Gita, and it comes from the term Bhagavan. When Krishna speaks in the book, it said, Bhagavan said. Okay, what's Bhagavan? Bhagavan means the person who's full in six opulences, six qualities. What's that? Beauty, knowledge, wealth, fame, strength, and detachment. Every one of us has some of these qualities to some extent. We have some beauty, we have some knowledge, we have some detachment, some strength, a little bit of fame. All of these qualities are found in all of us to some extent. But suppose I have some knowledge. There's someone with more knowledge than me. Then there's someone with more knowledge than him. And someone else with still more knowledge. And on and on. When you get to the person who has the most knowledge, that's Krishna. Yes, Krishna is God. The most knowledge, then the most fame. Who is more famous than God? Nobody. The most knowledge, the most fame, the most beauty. No one could be more beautiful than God. Is all beautiful things come from God? The most knowledge, the most fame, the most beauty. The most wealth, he owns everything. All the gold mines, all the silver mines, everything belongs to him.
I mean, it's very different because I would never expect to hear that God was a person.
Yes, it's very different because you'd never expect to hear that God was a person.
Yeah.
That's the distinctiveness of the Krishna consciousness movement, is that we're presenting Krishna as the Godhead, the Supreme, but the personality of Godhead.
Is that more of a way to connect?
Yeah, it's certainly easier. If you, suppose you try and meditate on the sky, on the clear blue sky. not a lot to meditate on there. Especially if you subtract the blue, then there's really nothing. But you could think of, say, a child, on and on. You know, how the child is laughing, how the child is smiling, who the child's parents are, you know, how when you tickle the child, how the child responds, and, you know, so many things, how clever the child is, whatever, on and on and on and on. You can think of a person, on and on and on and on. And thinking of something with no personal identity is practically impossible. So in the Bhagavad Gita, the question is asked, who's the better yogi? The one who thinks of the abstract, impersonal, all-pervading, formless, absolute? Or the person who's thinking of you in your personal form? And Krishna directly says, the one who's thinking of me is better. He's a better yogi. And, he says, the one who's trying to fix his mind on this impersonal, abstract, all-pervading, formless, absolute, is going to have a hard time. Klesha dikatodastecha. Trouble and more trouble. It's very hard. Not only is it more difficult, but the form is actually the higher aspect of God. In the Vedic literature, it's explained that God has both features. These are two ways of looking at God. You can look at God as being everywhere. God is everywhere. God is everything. And that's true. And one can look at God as the creator of everything, as the ultimate person, as the knower of everything. That's also true. And one could look at God as being within the heart of every living being. That's also true. So it's the literature says God has all three of these features, or can be seen from all three angles. And they're all the same God. The God who's all-pervading, the God who's in my heart, and the God who has his own personal kingdom, are the same God. But realized in progressively deeper, with progressively deeper understanding. In the beginning, God is everywhere, God is everything, God is... Then, still deeper, God is in my heart. And finally, God is a person with whom I can have a relationship, whom I can serve. Okay. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much answered it. Okay. You know, like compared to the Western concept of God, it's like what, like the biggest difference, you know?
The Western concept of God. There's a lot of Western concepts of God.
You know, I was going to use
Christianity
as an example.
Yeah, I was hearing a Christian theologian, and he was sort of addressing this question of Christian monotheism and saying, well, how monotheistic are we? Because we've got like, we've got one God, but really we've got three gods. It gets to be interesting. Comparative religion wouldn't be my strong point, but I would just say that I would offer that this gives people of any religion access to a deeper understanding of God. Doesn't really matter whether you're a Christian or you're a Muslim or you're Jewish or you're Jain or some other religion. But here's a way to understand God more deeply. You know, like Christianity doesn't say, well, God's not all-pervading. He's not everywhere, you know. No, he's all-pervading. He's everywhere. And Christianity also doesn't deny that God has a kingdom, that God is a person. And doesn't deny that God is within our heart. It accepts all of these understandings, but it's not very particular. You don't get a lot of information. God's in his kingdom. Well, where's that? And who else is there? And what do they do all day? And what's he look like? And they sort of sometimes have an imaginary picture that he's, well, he's the original person, so by now he must be really old, so he must have a big gray beard and furrowed brow and a lot of creases in the face. And, you know, so, but we get the information from Vedic literature about God's personality, God's personal characteristics. And it's a wonderful topic for understanding.
Just as a Christianity, we have an image of God. Is it the same thing with Krishna? Is there any image of
God? Yeah, you can see. Here's one, and here's another, and there are many such pictures of Krishna. Very sort of the most, I don't want to say typical, but Krishna is often seen as a, well, he's always seen as having a dark blue complexion. He's described in the literature as playing on a flute. He has a flute that he's playing. Yeah, you can see. And Venam Kanvantam Aravinda Dalayataksham, and his eyes are described as being like the petals of a lotus. And there's many descriptions how Krishna has very broad eyes that extend, you know, like the blossoming petals of a lotus. Beautiful blossoming eyes. Parahavatam Samasitam. And he's so beautiful that Cupid's falling on the floor. So I've never seen anyone this beautiful. His beauty is more enchanting than the beauty of Cupid multiplied by thousands and thousands of times. It's described that every part of his body is just beautiful. That his complexion is described as being Shama. Shama is not exactly blue and not exactly black, but it's described as being like the color of a monsoon cloud. Well, we don't have monsoon clouds here, but you can still see one in National Geographic. They're really something, you know, the dark, a very deep dark blue merging into gray, merging into black, that sort of a color. And that's, it's metaphorical. It gives us some sort of sense of his color. It's not exactly, you know, like you're trying to describe the color of, you know, fabric or something. You say, well, it's kind of like this or that. It's not the same as actually seeing the color. But Krishna's color is described as, by analogy, as being like the color of a monsoon cloud, which is a very beautiful color also, especially since the monsoon cloud comes at the end of summer, and summer is, in India, hot, hot, hot. And monsoon cloud means now the rains are going to come and everything is going to cool down. So it's, you know, wow, we're so happy to see those clouds. So Krishna's beauty is compared to the beauty of these monsoon clouds, and his complexion is compared in color to that that color.
Could the color also signify relief?
Would it signify relief?
Yeah.
It's not just symbolic, it's actually his color, but it gives relief. When one sees that color of Krishna, one can experience, or once sees Krishna with that color, one can experience relief from all miseries. It's that, yeah, like, what do they say, a sight for sore eyes. You know, our eyes have to see everything that's here in New York City, and if they're not sore by now. But, so then when one sees Krishna, it's like, it's also described netrotsava. Netra means the eyes, and utsava means a festival. So it's like a festival for the eyes to see the beauty of Krishna. Netrotsava. He has a peacock feather, thank you. He's described as wearing a peacock feather because there are peacocks in that village and they leave feathers, and Krishna decorates himself with these feathers. So it's like a special feature of Krishna that he's always decorated with a peacock feather. And Tribhanga Lalitam, it's said that he stands in a curved posture. You can see here, it's not the most sophisticated piece of artwork. But you can see that Krishna is standing in sort of a bending posture, which is also very attractive. So these are some of the, and that he's wearing, he wears bright yellow garments and golden ornaments and and he's surrounded by cows. You know, here we have like, usually it's dogs. But Krishna's favorite pet is the cow. So he enjoys playing the role of a boy who herds cows.
So Krishna is God.
Mm-hmm.
He also was a person.
He is a person. Yeah.
So is he considered to have been there since the beginning?
Yes. He exists since before the beginning. In eternal existence, Krishna is there. You know, where we have a beginning and an end. But Krishna's personal existence is beginningless and endless. Our personal existence is also beginningless and endless, but not the present personal existence. My personhood is, you know, I was born in Jersey City in 1949, and, you know, in such and such hospital, and when you read a few years later, it'll be, and I died in such and such place, and, you know, I've got a body that bleeds and suffers, and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. But Krishna's form is transcendental. It has no beginning, it has no end. It's not subject to any material conditions. And even our spiritual identity. It's said in the Bhagavad Gita that the soul, the self, can't be cut, can't be dried, can't be burned, can't be blown away, can't be drowned. It's beyond all these material conditions, but now it's covered by this material body. So when we become perfect in spiritual life, we revive our spiritual identity, we realize our spiritual identity and our relationship with the Supreme Spiritual Person, Krishna.
Can I just add one more question?
You certainly can.
Why is it that he wears gold?
Why is it that he wears gold?
No, I just want to ask for a possession reason. You know, you say things like, you know, you don't want to have any like connection to, you know, the material world.
Yeah. Well, the gold that Krishna wears is not material gold. The gold that Krishna wears is eternally existing as he is. Everything connected with Krishna may seem like what we have, but it's different. Because what we have, you know, we pick up our gold, we go dig for it in South Africa, we make all these miners suffer, and then we, you know, we hire some jewelers and we get some gold. The gold in the spiritual world is actually fully conscious. The ornaments of Krishna are as conscious as Krishna is. Krishna is supreme, he's the supreme conscious, but the his bracelets, his anklets, his everything in the spiritual world is conscious.
Is that supposed to be a connection between him and Mother Earth?
No, but the the earth, everything here is like a reflection of what's there. So here we have gold, but the gold is not eternally existing. Right? It just stays for some time. But there the gold is eternal. There the water is eternal. There Krishna's flute is eternal. Krishna's clothing is eternal. Krishna's place is eternal. The cows are eternal. Everything is eternal. Here we have the same thing. We have cows, we have flutes, we have gold. But they're like copies, like poor copies.
Bootleg.
Bootleg, yeah. The gray market. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much. Very good questions.
Maharaj, I just recollected a story of a pillow in Goloka where Krishna sleeps. Even pillow has a consciousness. It's a small story that pillow wants is usually it is under the head, but pillow wanted to serve Krishna. He wanted to have a rasa off his feet. So every time the servants of Krishna who are serving in Goloka, they'll keep the pillow on the head side, pillow will move to the side of his feet. And 2 days, 3 days, every day servants are noticing that why the pillow is moving this side. Then they got to know the pillow wants to. Even everything, those things that are we see material, in material worlds, they are just material, but everything in Goloka is the residence of Krishna, so everything has consciousness. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much. We have a book called The Krishna Book, which tells about all of these things in very pleasing detail. You can get it here. Something else? Yes?
Maharaj, how do we know, just looking at these texts in isolation, that Krishna isn't suggesting or advocating that we go to a secluded place?
He is advocating it.
And find it. So we should find a deer skin.
He's telling Arjuna this is what one has to do to practice yoga. But then you'll find in the coming verses that after Krishna describes the system in still further detail, Arjuna says, well, I've heard about the system. I can't do this. I can't follow the system. The mind is too restless. Chanchala hi mana Krishna. It's not possible for me to follow this yoga system. So Arjuna, although highly qualified, although living at the end of the previous age, although Krishna's personal friend, said that for me this system's not possible. And there's no record that he ever took it up. So then we can think, well, if Arjuna couldn't do it, how am I going to do it? And therefore we're recommended to take this bhakti yoga system. And we were reading in the purport that in the present age, no other method will be effective but this chanting. The chanting will be the most effective means of Krishna consciousness. Shall we stop here? I've been talking for a while. I think we can stop. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Shri Krishna.